right, team, how are we doing? Coach Dana Cavalier here, coming at you with the Becoming a Champion show. And I got a great episode for you today. You're going to love it. I had Dr. William Davis on the show today. He wrote a couple awesome books. Let me show you here. Bestseller, Wheat Belly, Lose the Wheat, Lose the Weight, and Find Your Path Back to Health. This was a really good one. And his newest book, which we dug into, is Super Gut. Two great books. I read them both and they are phenomenal. And I got to tell you, they will really change your life because they'll help you live your best life. More energy, leaner, without having to spend all your time at the gym. So check out this episode. You're going to love it. Dr. William Davis. This was a good one. If you like it, give us a thumbs up, give us some comments, and sit back and enjoy this great episode. I wanted to ask you, how did you get involved? First off, how did you get involved with medicine? What led you to this passion?
You know, it was mostly the science. I was always interested in health. I grew up as a really poor kid in suburban New Jersey. One bedroom house, Dana.
Wow.
Single mom, two sisters, and me. We used to go to the flea market, and I'd buy these big boxes. Remember the old, long time ago, you'd buy these big boxes of like books for a buck?
Oh, yeah.
I get like the old Prevention magazine, a big box for like a dollar or 25 cents. And I'd read them all. After a while, you start to realize, you know, cure cancer with vitamin C. No, I don't think so.
Yeah, the headlines. I got interested. Mm-hmm. Those headlines that grab you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I started out in engineering, Rensselaer, New York, Troy, New York.
Wow.
And found that I was not that smart. I thought I was smart. No, I'm not that smart. You get those Koreans and those Chinese kids coming in. They're smart. Holy right. crap, they're smart. In engineering, at least, you know? Mm. And I realized I would never excel in that area. So I dropped out and banged around for a while. Lived in Santa Barbara, lived in St. Louis, things like, and then finally found my way back. And I thought, hey, medicine.
Yeah.
Well, it was a long, hard slog, though, because I was dirt poor, had to get through on loans and grants and lying about my mom's income.
Whatever it takes.
But got through 17 goddamn years, Dana, wow. of education and training, because it was, I specialized, of course, in interventional cardiology, which is a very long training period.
Okay.
Only to realize, well into it, a few years into it, realize this is kind of stupid.
Mm.
That it really, it's a very fancy Band-Aid for a condition that you really can manage on your own with a little bit of benign help. You know, okay. just like, you know, you don't need a fancy procedure to lose weight. They try to tell you do, right? Lap band and a gastric bypass, but you don't need to. But that's what healthcare has become.
Yeah.
Trying to persuade people they need pharmaceuticals and procedures to be healthy, which is, of course, patent nonsense.
Mm.
And so it took me some, the odd thing was working in the cath lab doing procedures. I was pretty good at it and I had to abandon it because I thought it was, while it was interesting work and exciting and scientifically, it was wrong. It was just plain wrong, right. you know? And so, and then over the years, I gravitated towards preventive things and the crazy things I do now.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, so what led you to sitting down and saying, okay, I'm going to write this book? Because there had to be some emotion stirring within you. You had to have seen a lot. And then you say, okay, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to write my first book. Like I said, Wheat Belly. What drove you to that process where you say, hey, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to write this book. There's something important that I can contribute here to the health of Americans and really the globe.
Well, it was my mom's death from sudden cardiac death. Mm. So she had a two-vessel coronary angioplasty in Central Jersey. And then was found dead about 4 months later, almost certainly closure of the artery. Yeah. There was no autopsy, but almost certain. That's what happened. You balloon things, it comes back and sometimes catastrophically. So here, my mom, Dana, my mom dies of the disease that I was managing in a cath lab, right? So wow. I mean, a slap upside the head, right? Mm. So it was that kind of slap in the head that told me what you're doing is not smart.
Yeah.
Trying to save people as they're having a heart attack or they're having symptoms, putting in stents and sending the bypass surgery. And so I asked, you know, what if my mom had this all identified 5 years ahead of time, 10 years ahead of time? And is that possible? It is possible. It was possible back then. It was 25 years ago, and it remains true today. And the technology, while it's evolved, it's now a CT scan that generates coronary score. And it's just an index, a dipstick for how much coronary atherosclerosis you have. So I set up one of the first scanners in the Midwest here. I got some people together. $3 million. We opened Milwaukee Heart Scan and started scanning people left and right. And when you look for silent heart disease data years before trouble, it's everywhere. But what do you do about it? Of course, my colleagues say things like, well, oh, Dana, you know, you need a heart, the real test, heart catheter. You're a walking time bomb. Yeah. They persuade you to go through procedures like heart catheterizations and prophylactic stents and bypass, which is, there's no justification for that. There's no scientific justification for that, but it's commonly done. Whenever you get paid thousands and thousands of dollars, you know, a bypass surgery earns many thousands of dollars for the thoracic surgeon, somewhere in the neighborhood of $150,000 for the hospital. Mm-hmm. So they're all, you go to hospital meetings. The agenda is not how to improve care. It's how do we increase our procedural volume this year, 18%.
Right.
So there's this push. But I saw that was completely wrong. And back then, the only solution was baby aspirin, statin cholesterol drug like Lipitor at high dose, low-fat diet, exercise. Well, if you do nothing and you have one of those scores, let's say a score of 500, normal is zero, no plaque. So business guy, 52 years old, he says, oh, my dad had a heart attack, 59. I don't know, same things in my future. Oh, yeah, your score is 500. You're almost guaranteed to have a heart attack within the next 7-8 years. So he does nothing, which is unwise. Score goes up every year, 25% per year.
Wow.
We help publish that those data. If you go on the best there is in conventional medicine, low-fat diet, aspirin, statin, cholesterol, how fast go? 25% per year, Dana.
Wow, same.
No effect. Zero.
Wow, interesting.
On that measure.
Okay.
Well, what do you do? What do you do? I've got, you know, I'm the medical director of this scan center, and people are freaking out. My colleagues are taking advantage of them, putting them through unnecessary procedures. Well, it took some years to figure out, but it led to all kinds of great lessons, like adding vitamin D. Now, vitamin D depletion here, the deficiency is much worse because we're in the Midwest, upper Midwest, where there's not a lot of sun a lot of times.
Right.
So adding vitamin D was a huge, it was the first time I saw scores rather than going up, drop dramatically. But I also did lipoprotein testing because I rejected this ridiculous idea that cholesterol causes heart disease. That never was the intention, by the way. That's how it was misconstrued in the 1960s and 70s for in the service of Big Pharma and their statin drug franchise. So the better test is characterizing not the cholesterol as an indirect index of particles, but actual lipoprotein. You can measure them. They're easy. And you see that people with coronary disease uniformly have an excess of small LDL particles. And the science was clear, not my science, other people's science. The only foods that cause small LDL particles, wheat, grains, and sugars, not saturated fat, not fat, not corn oil. Just wheat, grains, and sugar. So I asked people to do that because they're freaking out, you know, and they did it. And then it works. Small LDL drops from high numbers like 2000 to zero. But that's when people started telling me all these crazy things, you know, like I lost 48 pounds. I'm no longer diabetic. I'm no longer hypertensive. My skin rash is gone. You know, all this, that's what led me to write the Wheat Belly book, just because trying to convey this, the science was the crazy thing, Dan. It was the science was already done. It wasn't like we had to start from scratch. The science was already done. But most of my colleagues don't read science. So you probably know that. Yeah. Maybe they read in a narrow area of their own area of specialty, but they don't have an interest or any kind of sophistication in issues like nutrition or nutrients, certainly not the microbiome. Right. And so we have this growing divide. The healthcare system and doctors are increasingly ignorant in health. Dana, well, in what world is that okay?
Yeah, right? No, it's not. You know? It's not. A lot of people today, they don't, you know, there's a lot of people that trust doctors, but then there's also a growing number that don't, you know, your traditional doctors, because saying, wait, I can't, every time I come here, you want to put me on more medication or a higher dosage. that can't, that's not health. That's truly medicine. That is medicine, right? It's you're giving me medicine and I don't want medicine. I want health. Now, I wanted to mention this too. You know, you mentioned wheat, grain, and sugar. Those are three somewhat addictive things to many. Doc, I can't take those out of my diet. I wanted to ask you, you know, where does somebody start? How do they begin to take those out of their diet? I mean, for some people, they could just say, I'm done. They have that sort of, you know, discipline and thanks. I have the information. This is great. I'm making a change. But for others, they say, I can't do that forever. I don't even know how to get started with that. Do you have any suggestions as to how somebody can start their journey, their return to health by eliminating wheat, grain, and sugar?
You know, there's several ways. For me, in practice, it was easy because these people are scared shitless, right? They got, you know, they have coronary disease. They've been told they have a chance maybe of dying 10% this year alone. So they're frightened and they will do it. So that's easy. And they see it graphically. We used to generate graphs of small LDL particles and other particles in the bloodstream. You see the massive distortion at the start. You see the complete normalization on the diet, Dana, with a few other nutrients added to influence insulin resistance. And they saw it graphically. When they see something like small LDL particles, bar graph, 2,400 nanomoles per liter, particle count per volume, drop to zero. Mm. And you're, oh, wow, this is not like, you know, oh, do this and you lose a few pounds or no, no, or reduce your cholesterol by 10%. No, no, this is obliteration, dramatic transformation of these markers, as well as drop in triglycerides, blood sugar, liver markers, AST, ALT, blood pressure, weight loss. Another thing is just educating people that it's not just about heart disease. It's also about, of course, type 2 diabetes. It's about Alzheimer's, dementia. Mm-hmm. It's about the skin rash or cataracts or ulcerative colitis or psoriasis. In other words, the consumption of wheat and grains and lack of nutrients to address insulin resistance shows itself in so many different ways, in ways that people didn't think had anything to do with their diet, but it does. And in some ways it was easy because once people took the leap, and by the way, went through an opiate withdrawal syndrome, that's another thing to go through by the first 5 days, and they start to realize, wow, I'm no longer hungry. I don't have mind fog. Mm. I'm losing weight and I'm not even trying. I feel better. My face is less red. I lost the seborrheic skin rashes. I'm regular. I'm more energetic. So when people experience that, and by the way, if you have an inadvertent or purposeful re-exposure to grains, you get sick. Yeah. Diarrhea, bloating, or recurrence of something that went away. Like if you had a skin rash that went away with the diet, it comes back. If you had joint pain that was relieved, it comes back sometimes for months. And so though it sounds dramatic and sounds hard to do, it's actually a lot easier than it seems at first. One lesson I also learned was, you know, every year the holidays would roll around and people would say, they'd come back to the office, everything's beautiful, right? They've done all kinds of great stuff. Coronary calcium score dropped from 800 to 450. They're no longer a pre-diabetic, etc. They come back after Thanksgiving, 14 pounds heavier and a metabolic disaster. And I'd say, Jack, what happened? He said, well, come on. Grandkids were over. Kids were over. I had to have biscuits and gravy and pumpkin pie, blah, 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 blah. So that would make me come up with recipes in recreating common dishes like that for holidays, for kids, for grandkids, for entertaining friends, etc. So you could have cheesecake, pizza, pie, and not experience weight gain nor metabolic distortions. And so there are ways to kind of stack the odds in favor of succeeding, but it does mean, and this is certainly true 10 years ago, less true today, that you end up making a lot of things because a lot of the stuff they buy, like gluten-free, is complete garbage that causes heart disease and dementia. It's just shocking, Dan, that people get away with selling that crap gluten-free processed foods.
I know. It is unbelievable. Most people don't take a deep enough look at their food. You know, we've become such consumers. You know, my wife and I, we were out the other day and we just saw these bellies everywhere. It was like the attack of the bellies, right? You see, you know, men 45, 50 years old, now even younger in their mid 30s. And they're all sporting the belly. And the way I see it is you see them, they're always pulling their shirt. That's a sign of the belly in addition to the visual sign of the belly. But you still see these folks not willing to make a full commitment to say, hey, I am going to get off the sugar, the grain, you know, and the wheat. I would love to ask you this. If somebody makes that decision today, you know, how long will it take before they start to feel the difference, let's say, see the difference even from the vanity side and the feel of, I feel better, I feel leaner, I feel healthier?
Well, there's about half the people who do this wheat grain sugar elimination thing. You know, there's a protein in wheat called gliadin. Mm-hmm. Wheat and grains are seeds of grasses, and we can't digest. We don't have the digestive enzymes to break down the protein specifically in wheat and grains. They're seeds of grasses. The gliadin protein specifically is broken down into peptides or fragments of 4 or 5 amino acid long peptides. And these peptides have been shown to have opioid properties. And this is not my research. This is NIH research. So this is government funded federal research. So the gliadin protein of wheat yields opioid peptides that act as appetite stimulants. When you go wheat and grain free, there is a soft opioid withdrawal process. You can provoke it, by the way, by giving somebody Narcan, naloxone, or naltrexone. Wow. About 5 days of nausea, depression, fatigue, suicidal thoughts sometimes. But then it goes away after 5 days. And then people say, wow, I feel great now. I'm no longer hungry. My mind fog is gone. My mood is great. So that takes about 5 days, give or take. It varies. As short as some people don't get it at all. Some people get it for 2 or 3 weeks, which is really tough. It also depends on how much weight you have to lose. If you've got 130 pounds of weight to lose, you're going to see all kinds of metabolic distortions in the process of losing weight, but you're going to feel a lot better. Yeah. But there's a lot depends on what measure you're looking at and how much weight you have to lose, whether there's an autoimmune or neurodegenerative disorder as part of the mix. So there's a lot of variables in here.
Yeah. I'm fascinated by it. I got to tell you, you know, I'm on day like 26 right now of like a complete elimination of all of those things. And it's amazing how much like just even my skin is tighter right in the middle. And I've actually strategically reduced my exercise. I was a 6 day a week exerciser. And I said, okay, I'm going to do my own little comparison. If I reduce my exercise significantly and just focus on the reduction of wheat, grain, and sugar, the elimination of it, what will happen? And I'm actually in better shape by not exercising as a result of just doing this. And now, I mean, I do exercise, but I've reduced my volume because so many of us, we lean on, okay, I could just outwork my bad diet. I'll just train harder. And when you're younger, maybe you think you can, and maybe you can. I'm not quite sure. But as you get older, you can't. Mm-hmm. And I know that for a fact.
You know, I'm always surprised that I thought I wrote the foreword to Novak Djokovic's book, and I thought about being, he says, gluten-free, which is a misleading way of putting it, but nonetheless, I thought he would spark this movement towards wheat and grain elimination for enhanced athletic performance. I think it's gotten a little bit of traction, but not as much as I thought it was going to, because it really does improve performance.
It does. I got to, you know, I was a heavier runner, right? I would run, go for a run, and I'd feel heavy. Now, again, I'm talking 25, 26 days later, I feel lighter, bouncing my steps. So it validates everything that we're talking about here. I'm just wanted to share that with anybody
that's great,
listening.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah, that it does make a tremendous difference. Now, some people may listen to this and say, hey, right now, most of my diet is wheat, sugar, and grain. I'm willing to make a change. Just because, I mean, any product you turn around that's packaged, you see added sugar, you see a ton of sugar. What are some foods that people can eat? You know, because there's some folks that are not versed in nutrition and science the way, you know, you are. What would you say, what are the foods that people can eat? Where can they start? Like, what is a food that's eligible?
You know, part of this is to reject the idea that we need to cut our fat and saturated fat. You know, that science was just never there. Even today, even the American Heart Association recently reiterated their stand on fat and saturated fat. And they actually said something like this. The signs from the 1950s and 1960s tell us that saturated fat causes cardiovascular. Come on, you kidding me? The 50s and 60s? And if you look at those studies, they're garbage. I mean, they were trying at the time. They weren't bad people. They just didn't have the scientific sophistication we have now in study design. So if you look at them, they're ridiculous. Things like this. They changed the diet 5 days a week in the hospital, sent them home for the weekend, and then tried to make predictions about cardiovascular. I mean, it was ridiculous study constructions. And then, of course, there's the Harvard School of Public Health, where Frank Sachs and Frank Hugh and Walter Willett published the garbage studies. That is the observational epidemiological. Dana, what did you eat Monday? You say, I think I had 2 eggs and maybe, what'd you have for lunch? Well, maybe I ordered out from Chipotle that day. And then we contact you in 5 or 10 years and say, how you doing? You say, well, you know, I had this or I didn't have. That data is garbage.
Yeah.
It is largely not true. And this is not my opinion. This is well sorted out that you can't, all those kinds of studies do is suggest an hypothesis. Yet the USDA saw fit to use it as evidence. And so that was the origin of the cut your fat, cut your saturated fat, eat more healthy whole grain nonsense. So it means kind of a wholesale rejection of dietary guidelines and advice. So go back to real food. You know, if you and I didn't get up this morning in a nice house or condo or, you know, with air conditioning or heating, instead you grab your spear, bow and arrow, axe, or club, and killed something, perhaps ate its stomach and intestines on the spot, dragged the carcass back, cooked it over a fire, ate the brain, heart, tongue, pancreas, thymus, kidneys, liver, then the meat.
Yeah.
No one's worrying about fat. We're getting all the nutrients we need, like collagen and hyaluronic acid, from eating the carcass of that animal. We then dig in the dirt for roots and tubers. We gather berries and nuts. Now, obviously, no one's going to do this, these kinds of things in a modern world, but we mimic that behavior as best we can. And you find there's a ton of foods, but it's not going to come in cellophane paper. It's not going to, or a wrap. It won't come through a drive-through window.
So with that, you know, people love to put titles to things. I could see somebody hearing what you just said and say, well, is this keto? Is this paleo? What is this Atkins of yet? Like, so how do you differentiate what, you know, your suggestion and what those, you know, how people may want to classify? I mean, cause what you explained, I guess there are elements of paleo and keto and right.
Mm-hmm. There's some differences at the edges, fine differences and nuances. One, we don't stop at diet. There are other things you want to do besides diet. Like, you know, we have to get magnesium because, you know, Dana and his family don't drink from the river or stream because if you did, you'd get sewage and farm runoff and pesticides and herbicides. So the city filters your water. Maybe you filter your water and water filtration removes all magnesium. Got to address magnesium. You're in Florida, but you know what? I bet you even you. I know you wear clothes. You spend a lot of your days indoors.
Yeah,
and as we hit 40 and beyond, we start to lose the capacity to activate vitamin D in the skin. Of course, most people don't eat liver, so we lack vitamin D. And so we replace those nutrients. So there's differences there also. And there's some real mistakes being made by the ketogenic, carnivorous, and the ultra-low-carb people. So I think low-carb is a superior way of living, but not taken to extremes. One of the things that happens, Dana, is you eat fibers and polysaccharides to feed bacteria in your GI tract, presumptively the colon. If you don't get those things because you're carnivorous or ketogenic, and you starve healthy microbes, they start to die off or at least are diminished in numbers. But there are several species, the most important of which is called Akkermansia mucinophila. So Akkermansia, when you deprive it of fibers and polysaccharides, has the capacity to eat human mucus, Akkermansia mucinophila, mucus lover. And it starts to eat the intestinal lining.
Wow.
And you get colitis. So this is what happens. He's like, oh, wow, it's great. I lost 47 pounds. My blood pressure's down. My fatty liver reversed. My blood sugar's I'm doing great. I lost, you know, 8 inches off my waist. And then a year, 18 months into it, they say, I don't know what's going on. I'm constipated. My blood sugar's going back up. My blood pressure's going back up. I'm having some odd abdominal symptoms, like low-grade pain and bloating. So they allow acromantia also, but the acromantia starts to actually consume the intestinal lining. And you get also endotoxemia, the entry of bacterial breakdown products from the microbiome into the bloodstream. You can measure it. And so it's a disaster long-term. There's going to be probably a big uptick in colon cancer and autoimmune diseases in people who are guilty of sticking to the ketogenic diet too long. I wish that wasn't true, Dana. It's not my interest to, you know, pick at people and say, oh, you know, and try to nitpick. But ironically, of all the diets, the best studied scientifically, or at least among the best, is the ketogenic diet. Because it was followed for a century in children who had intractable seizures. Wow. And it reduces seizure frequency about 50%. These are kids, if they don't stop having seizures, they have brain damage. It's real bad. So they go on a ketogenic diet. Seizure frequency drops by 50% or so. What happens to these kids' health? They stop growing. They develop osteopenia as kids. There's 8% with kidney stones. These are kids not supposed to get kidney stones.
No.
They get constipated. They have major disruptions of the intestinal microbiome. They have metabolic distortions. Despite the initial, you know, upfront benefits, there's long-term deterioration. So all kinds of health problems long-term. And that's established fact because it's been studied in the setting of intractable seizures. Now, some of the apologists for the ketogenic diet said, well, that's because they use corn oil. That's true. Up till about 20 years ago, they were using corn oil. It was a really bad idea. More recently, it's not been corn oil. It's been olive oil and lard and coconut oil and butter and those kinds of things. But all those things still happen. So, paleo is probably closest. But as you see, these diets all depend on what personality is advocating. There's, you know,
right.
But it has to do a lot with what is our genetic code reflects adaptation to life on this planet in different ways. Life in Africa, life for the Inuit, life in the Brazilian rainforest. So there's some differences, but there are a lot of similarities also.
Yeah. And that was something I was thinking about, you know, as I was reading through this, you know, let's say you're of Italian descent and you grow up in Italy and pasta is a part of the diet, you know, it could be harder for somebody like that to just eliminate it, but based on their geography, are they built the same or do they, you know what I mean? I'm looking at it, just thinking about it, saying, it's, you know, people that are accustomed to a certain diet or someone that's Asian, that's brought up on rice. You know what I mean?
So 10,000 years is not long enough to make major changes in the genetic code. There are some adaptations. So for instance, the gene for hemochromatosis appeared 6,000 years ago in people of Western European descent. And that was an adaptation that's presumed to be due to the presence of phytates in grains. So the phytates in grains bind mostly iron in your diet. You poop it out in the toilet. Well, that's a problem. If you're iron deficient in a primitive society and your hemoglobin is 7 or 8, and you're breathless and cold all the time, you can't hunt, you can't gather, you're freezing to death. And what do? Well, you die, or you're going to starve, or something bad happens to you. So a mutation appeared about 6,000 years ago to cause iron hyperabsorption. So there's only a handful of these mutations, though, that have cropped up as adaptations to grain, in this case, to an adaptation to the phytates. The other thing is that a lot of the changes introduced into wheat and grains, as well as other foods, have been recent, like the last 50 years. And so you can't really, so the change in the gliadin protein, for instance, that's responsible for a fourfold increase in celiac disease, only happened about 50 years ago. So not long enough to have made that adaptation. Yes. There has been also an increase in the amylase gene number. some people have multiple amylase genes as a partial adaptation to accommodate the amylopectin A of grains. That's the carbohydrate that's responsible for raising blood sugar sky high. So there are partial adaptations, and it'll probably be another 30, 40, 50,000 years. And maybe at that point, wheat and grains will be healthy for you.
Yeah.
But I don't feel like waiting.
Yeah, no, I don't blame you. And, you know, as you're saying that, I'm thinking of, like, you know, folks that are my father's age, you know, in his 70s, and he would say, you know, my mother had grains as a young lady, and then she grew up on a farm, and she died when she was 101. But to your point, that was when grains were, you know, they were different grains than they are today.
And there's other things too. And of course, there's always exceptions to rules. So
right.
you've heard all this. Oh yeah, my great uncle lived till age 88 smoking two packs of cigarettes. Does that mean all the science on cigarette smoke is now negated?
Yeah.
No, of course not. So
yeah, these are the outliers. So you have, you know, now, you know, Wheat Belly was your entry point to introduce the world to these ideas and this research that you studied. And now you move to the new book, Super Gut. I was going through it, and there was a couple things in there that I know are not people don't typically hear of, like SIBO and CIFO. Can you explain those two?
Do you want to record this, Dana? You want to just?
Oh, we're recording.
Oh, we are recording. Oh, sorry.
this is all conversational, Doc. You know, yeah. So
sorry.
Sure.
Yeah. So, you know, again, we've been exposed as a society worse than the U.S., not quite as bad other parts of the world like Europe and Asia. But we've been overexposed to, of course, antibiotics. So by age 40, most of us have gotten 30 courses of antibiotics. It's even worse in kids nowadays. For every 1,000 children, more than 1,300 prescriptions are written every year. Chlorinated drinking water, fluoridated drinking water, prescription drugs like stomach acid blocking drugs, anti-inflammatory drugs, statin cholesterol drugs, birth control pills, food additives like food preservatives like potassium sorbate, emulsifying agents like carrageenan polysorbate 80 and carboxymethylcellulose, synthetic sweeteners like aspartame, sucralose, and saccharin. Heavy metals, BPA, bisphenol, we're swimming an ocean of factors disrupting our microbiomes. And so one of the things that's happened is we've lost hundreds of species, some of which were very important, that did had specific functions in the human body. And unfortunately, this is the part you're asking about. When you lose those healthy species, including very important foundational species that support other microbes, in their place, you have proliferation of unhealthy microbes. And these are largely stool-type microbes like E. coli and Salmonella and Klebsiella and Staphylococcus and Streptococcus. The odd thing, though, is in many people, and I thought this was rare. I was guilty in my undoctored book in 2015. I said this was uncommon. I was wrong. This idea that when you have loss of healthy microbes, proliferation of unhealthy microbes in many people, conservatively estimated 100 million people, those unhealthy microbes have ascended into the small bowel, into the ileum, jejunum, duodenum, and stomach, such that you get 30 feet of microbes, 30 feet, trillions of microbes. They only live for minutes to hours, not decades. They're turning over very rapidly. When they die, a lot of their breakdown products enter the bloodstream. People call it gut leak. And it was only speculative for a long time, but it's finally been scientifically validated by a series of research that came out of Belgium, now France. Dr. Patrice Cannon, he showed that this process called endotoxemia comes from bacteria in the intestines. But this process of endotoxemia tells us how the microbiome can be experienced as rosacea or psoriasis in the skin. Or as the joint pain of fibromyalgia or rheumatoid arthritis, or as the brain as depression or Alzheimer's dementia or Parkinson's disease. In other words, the microbiome can be experienced in virtually every organ of the body means that all human disease essentially has to be reconsidered in light of this. But it also means that if all you do, for instance, take a drug that blocks some inflammatory pathway, for instance, for polymyalgia, you did nothing for the intestinal cause. Mm. And now you're a setup for autoimmune diseases, intestinal diseases, neurodegenerative diseases. And so if all you do is block some pathway, or if you just, let's say, take a drug like insulin to reduce blood sugar, but you did nothing for the microbiome that is contributing to obesity, diabetes, blood sugar, insulin resistance, you're going to have signs of long term. So the bottom line, you got to address the microbiome.
Yeah. And is it fair to say that the start of that addressing the microbiome is through, again, the elimination of the wheat, the grain, and the sugar?
That's a nice start, because wheat and grains are so highly inflammatory to the human GI tract. Inflammation in and of itself changes the microbiome. And so we need more science for the exact changes that occur, but we do know there are disruptions to the microbiome, a lot of it by way of inflammation. And by the way, you know, the thing that turned my head and made me realize that this process, 30 feet of microbes, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, SIBO,
yeah,
it showed me that this is far more common, is this device here, the air device. This is the old one. The new one came out a few weeks ago. It's black, but it measures hydrogen gas in the breath, which allows you and me to map out where microbes are. Unfortunately, the guy who invented it, who's a friend of mine now, Dr. Angus Short, he's a PhD engineer in Dublin, Ireland. He developed this device because his fiance, then now his wife, has had irritable bowel syndrome and was told to go on a low FODMAPs diet, a low fiber, low sugar diet, because that's been shown to reduce bloating and diarrhea and some of the symptoms of IBS. But he saw how difficult it was. So he invents this device to detect hydrogen gas. So when his wife would get exposed to, say, let's say, some sugar or fiber, she could tell, because the hydrogen gas level would go up, because humans don't produce hydrogen gas, but bacteria do.
Got it.
So unfortunately, Angus releases this product about 2 or 3 years ago as a device he thought to navigate irritable bowel syndrome and low FODMAPs diet. So I get a hold of it. It's became clear. No. He's an engineer. He's not a physician. He's not a gastroenterologist. I call this, Angus, this is far more than that. This is a device that maps out where in the GI tract unhealthy microbes are.
Mm.
And it helps you navigate food intolerances, whether it's FODMAPs or histamine-containing foods or nightshades or fruit or legumes. All you've heard these people, I can only eat 7 foods. Or I can't eat this list of 43 foods. That's all SIBO. It's the SIBO. So if all you do is eliminate the foods that make you sick, you've done nothing for the unhealthy microbes you have in your GI tract causing these intolerances, which never happened to grandma, right? These are modern phenomena.
Yeah. So is that where, you know, again, I'm just thinking about, you know, somebody that may be listening to this say, oh, well, but I take probiotics, so I should be good.
So let's take the situation of SIBO, 30 feet, trillions of microbes. Let's say you pay a lot of money for a very expensive probiotic. Will your SIBO go away? No. they're not intended to do that. Commercial probiotics are kind of haphazard collections of microbes, each of which are felt to be beneficial. A lot of the newest science has not been incorporated into commercial probiotics. So probiotics, while they're helpful, they do stimulate mucus production for your protection. They do help compete with pathogenic microbes like E. coli. But they don't do it anywhere close to the things they really could do. So one of the things I did with SIBO, and this is speculative, this is very preliminary, Dana. So I asked, well, okay, we have 30 feet, unhealthy microbes, doing all kinds of weird things to your body. What if we chose microbes, not a haphazard collection in a probiotic? Let's choose microbes that colonize the upper GI tract. That's where SIBO occurs. Let's choose microbes that produce what are called bacteriocins. These are natural antibiotics produced by bacteria effective against a species of SIBO. So I chose three, a strain of Lactobacillus gastrui, colonized the upper GI tract, and it's a bacteriocin powerhouse, produces up to seven bacteriocins. I chose Lactobacillus rotari, colonized upper GI tract, produces up to four bacteriocins. And a strain I bet you'd like a lot, I'll tell you why, called Bacillus coagulans, only one bacteriocin. But we fermented it as a yogurt. Prolonged fermentation to jack up the numbers very high, hundreds of billions per half cup serving. And this is preliminary, but so far about 30 people have done this. 90% have normalized their breath hydrogen gas and said things like, finally, I broke my weight loss plateau. Finally, my blood sugar dropped. Finally, my small LDL particles dropped. Finally, I got rid of the anxiety. In other words, the correction of that problem seems to correlate. Now, we'll do that in a formal trial down the road, not with yogurt, of course. We'll have to encapsulate it so we can control the counts. But I think we're on to a way to use, Dana, yogurt to correct the situation.
Wow, very cool. So when you say, what is it, just so we know, what is a commercial, what would you consider, what's, if it's not a commercial probiotic, what is it? Like, what's the alternative to a commercial?
So we do several things. So one, we restore specific microbes. Let me tell you about my favorite microbe in the world, which is Lactobacillus rotari. That's one of the ones in the SIBO yogurt.
Yeah.
So rotari, named after the German microbiologist who discovered it in human breast milk in 1962. Mm-hmm. And he made the observation, the informal observation, that rotari was easy to find. He'd find it in breast milk of mothers, stool of humans. And as the decades passed, he noticed it was harder and harder to find. And then more recent evidence that almost nobody has it anymore because it's very susceptible to common antibiotics like ampicillin or amoxicillin you may have taken for a sinus infection or upper respiratory infection. So almost everybody's lost it. Now, if we look at the data on indigenous populations, like in New Guinea or the Brazilian rainforest, they all have rotari. Mm-hmm. If we look at the microbiomes of the squirrel outside or the possum or the chipmunk, they all have rotari. Mm-hmm. We don't have it anymore. So one of the things we do is we get it and we cultivate it as a yogurt. Not to be confused with store-bought yogurt. That's something entirely different. This just happens to look and smell like yogurt, but it's not yogurt. Prolonged fermentation. We counted the microbes in it. You get about 250, 260 billion microbes per half cup serving. We eat that yogurt. And one of the things this microbe does is it, as you recall, it colonizes the upper GI tract, sends a signal via the vagus nerve, a retrograde signal to the vagus nerve to the brain, to release oxytocin, the hormone oxytocin. A lot of your listeners will remember oxytocin is the hormone of love and empathy.
Yeah.
And what happens is people eat this yogurt and they say things like, I like my spouse better. It's rekindled our affection. I like my family better. I find them less annoying. I like my coworkers better. I see other people's points of view more easily. But that's just the emotional, social part, which is important. But there's other things. Ladies love it because they start to lose their skin wrinkles within 8 weeks because there's an explosion in dermal collagen. Guys love it, and this is relevant to your world. There's a huge restoration of youthful muscle and strength.
Wow.
I'm going to be 65 in about 3 months or so. And I gained 13 pounds of muscle in 3 weeks doing this at the very start. Unlike you, Dana, I hate going to the gym.
Yeah.
I go pre-pandemic, I was going 15 minutes once a week.
Okay.
Just quick circuit right through the machines, get the hell out, right? Out.
Yeah.
I gained 13 pounds of muscle doing that once a week, occasionally twice a week. And my strength went up by about 50%. It sounds ridiculous. I know. Yeah. I was doing lat pull downs, like 130 pounds for 10 reps, went up to 200 pounds in my 60s.
Wow. Yeah, it's
a leg press. You know, the leg press machine I have at the club only goes to 415 pounds, and I'm too lazy to use the plates. So I just use 415 pounds just to
rub it out.
Yeah. There's also an increase in libido, restoration of youthful libido, and it increases the erotic content of your dreams like you had when you were 18 years old. It suppresses appetite. It deepens sleep. I'm a chronic insomniac, you know, watching TV, reading books, 2 a.m. I now sleep 9 hours straight through. It prolongs REM sleep, a deep restorative phase of sleep. It preserves bone density in ladies. So when you think about this, Dan, so preserves bone density, restoration, youthful muscle, increased libido, a smoother skin. I think we're turning the clock back 10 years, maybe 20 years. That's just one microbe.
Wow. Interesting.
Another microbe you might be interested in is Bacillus coagulans, the GBI 3686. It's also in Eden's. And you can buy this as a commercial product. And I'm blanking on the commercial name. I'm not good at that part. But there is some preliminary science, human science, telling us that. So you know this. If you're engaged in some heavy physical exertion, whether it's running a marathon, a triathlon, you get muscle breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
So let's take a marathon. We're going to draw your creatine kinase, a muscle protein at the start. Slow muscle turnover, maybe 140. You cross the finish line, 26 miles, you're vomiting, diarrhea, right? Chugging down those drinks. Your creatine kinase went from 140 to 2,000, 2,400. And that's why some people, after extreme exertion, pee brown. That's muscle breakdown.
Yeah.
That's rhabdomyolysis.
Yep.
Well, Bacillus coagulans, at least in one preliminary study, cut muscle injury by half.
Wow.
Meaning... Well, that, you know, I learned this lesson because my daughter, when she had those concussions as a tennis player, she fell off the charts in her ranking, and she had to qualify for the main draw at Wimbledon, French Open, and all that business. And you've probably seen the qualifying rounds are every day, unlike the main draw, it's every other day. And so the qualifying rounds are killers. You win one round, got to do it again. Next day, got to do it again. Next day, and if you continue, got to now join the main draw, and you're exhausted and sore. Well, I have her get Bacillus coagulans, and it drops her soreness and accelerates her recovery. So there's a performance improvement aspect to the Bacillus coagulans.
And is that something you should be taking daily? Should you be taking these daily?
So you can buy it as a commercial probiotic, and forgive me, I'm blanking on the brand name. It's in the Supergut book, though. But you can buy this at, you know, Target, Walgreens, CVS, for a few dollars. The problem with a lot of commercial probiotics, like the Rotari or the Gasteri we use for SIBO, or the Bacillus coagulans we use for acceleration of recovery and reduction, by the way, of arthritis pain, is they sell it to us in relatively trivial counts.
Okay.
So that Rotari, for instance, one of the products we'll use is something called Gastrus, G-A-S-T-R-U-S. It comes from Sweden. And they sell it to you in what sounds like a lot. It's 100 million. Well, 100 million sounds like a lot, but it's almost nothing in bacteria because those tablets are made for infants.
Right.
And so if an adult takes it, we want these skin effects, deep sleep, strength, muscle. Well, how do you get hundreds of billions? So we ferment it.
Okay.
Now, bacterial reproduction is, so you likely know that bacteria don't have mommies and daddies, right? There's no male and female bacteria. One bacteria doubles to become two, two becomes four. They have so-called asexual reproduction. Hmm. Well, Rotari, for instance, doubles every 3 hours.
Wow.
At 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, so, you know, if you buy commercial yogurt, one, it doesn't have Rotari. It has Lactobacillus bulgaricus and some other ho-hum boring microbes. And they only ferment for 4 hours.
Hmm.
So there's almost nothing in commercial yogurt. We're going to ferment for 36 hours.
Wow.
And it allows at least Rotari, a little different with other microbes with different time courses. But Rotari doubles every 3 hours. So 12 doublings, that's what gives us. To illustrate, the easiest way to illustrate this to your listeners is that old riddle that kids tell, which would you rather have, $1 million or a penny that doubles every day for 30 days? Kids always say, I'll take $1 million, because who would have thought? But a penny becomes $5.5 million a day 30. But if you look at the increase in money, it doesn't really get underway till about day 28. And so same thing with microbial doubling. When you allow it to double, let's say every 3 hours for 36 hours, the real increase in numbers doesn't occur until about hour 33.
Wow.
So if you're making yogurt in a factory for 4 hours, or some homemakers do it for 12 hours, you got nothing. You're on the flat portion of the curve. So it's a bit of a, and by the way, it doesn't have to be yogurt. You can ferment other things, though yogurt is among the most forgiving and easiest to do. But you can do coconut milk. You can do hummus is real friendly for fermentation. I ferment a lot of fungi in juices, very easy to do. Because we want these big numbers. So we want like 100 billion plus. So we actually increase it 100 to 1,000 fold by doing this, and you get much bigger health benefits.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating stuff because, you know, so many people today, it's like, I don't feel good, let me go to the doctor. They get, and then they get on a prescription or something, and then all of a sudden now they're dealing with the next thing, and their body is constantly being challenged by what it is that they're putting in their body in order to save their body, yet they're regressing in that, you know, what it is that they want to achieve, which is health, which is kind of how we started today. So this is really insightful. And, you know, again, I never want people to feel like, oh my gosh, this is so hard. So that's why I'm glad we went into a lot of the benefits of actually, you know, taking this seriously and beginning to eliminate the things that are catalysts of inflammation, because now people understand why it's so important. They understand the symptoms, that rash that you have, it may not have just shown up, you know, because today you were due for a rash or that, you know what I mean? And I think that's how a lot of people think. They're like, oh, today's rash day, dermatologist, rub it down and continue.
You know, some people, then it do get overwhelmed. They say, oh my God, all this talk of microbes and fermenting. So I tell people, think of it like going to a restaurant. You know, if you walk into a nice restaurant and the waitress hands you a menu, you don't freak out and say, there's no way I can order all these appetizers and main dishes, right? You pick and choose the ones you want. Same thing here. If you want smoother skin, deeper sleep, increased strength and muscle mass, let's ferment rotari. If you want accelerated recovery as an athlete or heavy physical labor and reduction in arthritis pain in your knee, let's ferment Bacillus coagulans. If you want, let's say you have a baby, you want that baby to sleep through the night, cut its bowel movements in half, so fewer diaper changes for mom and dad, have less colic, less crying, less fussiness, and as an older child, less asthma, less type 1 diabetes, less autoimmune disease, less irritable bowel syndrome, less likely to be obese as a teenager, and have a higher IQ, let's ferment Bifidobacterium infantis. So you can pick and choose the microbe for the effect you want. Yeah. But I should mention also, but the most important thing people can do after wheat and grain elimination is bring back fermented foods like your great-grandma did. That is a really powerful strategy. Kefirs, kombucha, sauerkraut, fermented sauerkraut, kimchi, veg, and it should be almost no cost. You can ferment veggies on your counter. It's very easy. I have instructions in the Super Gut book. There's many other websites and books that tell you how to ferment foods, and they're delicious. But, you know, we all forgot that because when home refrigeration became affordable in 1927 with Frigidaire and the discovery of Freon as a refrigerant, everybody thought fermented foods were rotten, not recognizing that soupy mix is actually very helpful for health. It's probably the biggest thing people could do.
Wow.
Make it a habit of incorporating fermented foods several times per day.
Wow. Very interesting. Yeah. And I would think that the American palate today is not really conditioned for that. Or even, you know, folks that are, you going shopping, you're not thinking about anything fermented. You're just, we're not conditioned that way anymore. So again, as I listen to you speak, I say, wow, what an opportunity that we all have for reconditioning our habits, reconditioning our behaviors, our mindsets, and our choices. You know, so many people I meet are like, I'm so bored of you. I eat the same thing every day. I'm bored. And it's like, well, today is a great opportunity for you to exchange that boredom for opportunity and better health. So make sure
you well said.
Take advantage of that.
Now, people will say things like, oh, I can't do that. I tried to have some kimchi or some kefir and it made me sick. Or I tried to take a probiotic and it made me sick. Or I can't get legumes. You said they have fiber. They make me sick. Well, the problem is not the food. The problem is the SIBO you've got, the small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. So any kind of reaction that's is adverse reactions, whether it's bloating, diarrhea, abdominal discomfort, anxiety, panic attack, anger in males. These are almost diagnostic for SIBO, by the way, especially if they occur within the first hour to 90 minutes of consumption, because that means bacteria are way up high in your GI tract. So people should not say, oh, I try to eat fermented foods, it makes me sick, so I can't eat fermented. No. Well, hold off for the time being, but address your microbiome.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the part that I'm fascinated with, because, you know, just, and I know we're getting, you know, run out of time, but with the SIBO, is it as eliminate those, you know, again, wheat, grain, and sugar, and then start to introduce these other bacteria? Is that, fair to say, or these probiotics, yeah, these healthy bacteria?
You know, the best sequence is I would do the diet, yep, the basic nutrients we address, vitamin. You know, I did not know this, Dana. So before I was paying deep attention to the microbiome, we included magnesium, vitamin D, iodine, and omega-3 fatty acids because they're lacking in modern life, not the diet, but modern life. And they influence insulin resistance. It improves insulin resistance, which is a major underlying process that leads to weight gain, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, dementia, cancers. So those nutrients contribute to reversing that situation. What I didn't recognize is those four basic nutrients also have influences on bowel flora and the intestinal lining. Mm. For instance, omega-3 fatty acids from fish oil activate an enzyme called intestinal alkaline phosphatase, which partially deactivates those endotoxins from bacteria. So even though I didn't intend it, it turned out that that little menu of four nutrients also has very beneficial effects on the microbiome. So there's that. Now, I'd like to tell people, you know, the part that most people like to talk about is, oh, I want that Rotari for better skin and muscle, or I want the Bacillus coagulans for reduction in knee pain or hip pain. But the best results are if you first address the SIBO and SIFO also, by the way, if you have that too, small intestinal fungal overgrowth. Because if you throw your healthy microbes like Rotari into a snake pit of E. coli and Klebsiella, you know, this doesn't work very well. But I offer this possible. So you could talk to your gastroenterologist. And that's a tough nut to crack because most of them will say, don't waste my time. There's nothing wrong with you. I didn't see anything on the scope because you can't see it on a scope. Yeah. Or did you consult Dr. Google again? So they're so, most of them are so far behind the science that they won't even recognize what you're talking about. The occasional one who does will hand you a prescription, typically for rifaximin, which is the prescription antibiotic, which only about 50% of the time works. Typically doesn't tell you how you got it, how to increase the efficacy, or how to prevent the very frequent recurrences. There are herbal antibiotics, only two of which have any kind of evidence of efficacy, the candibactin regimen and the fcsidyl and dysbiocide. It's in the Supergut book, yep, and we just do it that way. But I think, Dana, it is preliminary, but so far that SIBO yogurt seems to be doing the trick. You have to do it longer, though, more like 4 weeks rather than 2 weeks. Antibiotics are typically taken for 10 to 14 days. We've been doing the SIBO yogurt for 28 days or so, 30 days. And it's so far, 90% of people converted to H2 negative using the air device. So I'm crossing my fingers. This continues to hold up because that would, it's a little bit of effort. You got to track down the microbes, got to ferment and make some yogurt out of it. But it's yogurt. Yeah, you know, if I said, Danny, you need a frontal lobotomy or we're going to remove your colon colectomy. Well, we better be damn sure, right, that this is necessary because the treatment is so horrendous. But what if the potential means of managing it is yogurt?
You know? Yeah, fantastic.
When the bar is not very high.
Yeah, yeah. No, this is excellent. Doc, I appreciate you coming on and sharing your knowledge and experience with me and everybody else that's going to be listening to this. I think it's fascinating. I know it's fascinating because I have my own notes to my left right now. So it's this is excellent. I like to end the show with one last question for you. I call this the Becoming a Champion show. I feel like we're all on a journey to become a champion. What does the word champion mean to the doc? A little something fun.
You know, I see my poor daughter going through all the ups and downs of a professional tennis life. You know, I think of her as a champion because she may not be, you know, winning 6-0, 6-0 against Serena.
Right.
But she trains hard. She plays hard, you know, because she's in your neighborhood. And, you know, playing in Southern Florida at 95 degree humid days and doing it day after day is not. So I regard the people who are trying to do their best as the champions. Yeah, you don't have to be number one. Nice to be number one, but I see what it takes, Dana, and you know this far better than I do, but you see what it takes to really be good at something.
Yeah, no, that's so true. This is awesome. I appreciate you coming on and sharing this with me. So thank you very much for that.
Well, thank you, Dana, because you're doing a lot of good. You're spreading word to a population that don't often hear the full truth in health. That's very important. So please keep on doing what you're doing also.
Oh, I certainly will. All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode. Most importantly, whenever we do these episodes, I hope you take a pen. I hope you take a pad. You write down some notes. And most important, you write down what it is that you're going to take action on. Because if you just listen to these episodes and you don't take action, and you move right on to the next one, you're not getting as much out of them as you should and as you could. So let's commit to putting something into action here. Take something from today's episode from Dr. William Davis and put it into action. Get yourself started. Eliminate sugar, wheat, and grain for just a few days and see how you feel. That's my message for you today. I'm Coach Dana Cavalier. I hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Becoming a Champion show. And if you did, again, give us a like, give us a share, give us a thumbs up. And for those of you on YouTube, give us a comment and let us know what you think of today's episode. We'll see you next week with another episode of the Becoming a Champion show. See ya.